You're listening to an episode of The Rewind, a podcast series by the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies in Grand Rapids, Michigan. This episode features the audio from the Common Ground Initiative's 2023 Progressive Conservative Summit on April 19th, 2023. This year's summit had the topic of preventing political violence. This keynote is titled Contemporary Political Violence and New Policy Approaches and is presented by Dr. Javed Ali, Associate Professor of Practice at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy. This event was offered in partnership with the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Foundation and featured Professor Ali's keynote and questions from our live audience. If you'd like to learn more about this event or our speakers, please visit gvsu.edu/hc/progcon23, which is linked in the description below. Enjoy the episode. We begin our event today with Professor Javed Ali, who will offer us some context going into today's program. Professor Ali is an Associate Professor of Practice at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy. Ali brings more than 20 years of professional experience in national security and intelligence issues in Washington, D.C. He held positions at the Defense Intelligence Agency and the Department of Homeland Security before joining the Federal Bureau of Investigation. While at the FBI, he also held senior roles on joint duty assignments at the National Intelligence Council and the National Counterterrorism Center, as well as work for the National Security Council under the Trump administration. Ali holds a Bachelor of Arts in Political Science from the University of Michigan, a Juris Doctor from the University of Detroit School of Law, and a Master's of Arts in International Relations from American University. He writes and provides commentary across a number of media sites and platforms, including ABC, BBC, CBS, CNN, MSNBC, NPR, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Hill, and Newsweek. Please join me in welcoming Professor Ali.
Kaler, thank you so much for that introduction. So I made it in time from Ann Arbor this afternoon. I left at 11 o'clock and I made it here in a couple hours and didn't get pulled over once. So that was a good news story on my part. We're really excited to be here. And sounds like we've got a great program for you today. And again, I'm honored to be here. So as Kaler mentioned, I'm here today to hopefully help kick things off and provide some perspectives on this topic of political extremism and violence in the United States. You know, that may not be the right term. Other people would call it domestic extremism or domestic terrorism. So whatever the right term is, that's the subject I want to get into. And the perspectives I'm going to offer are sort of blended from my position over the past few years teaching at Michigan, which has given me a little bit more time to step back and think about not only current events, but how sort of current events connect to, how current events connect to history. And so part of my presentation will take us back into sort of previous decades in the country and some of what these trends look like in terms of political violence and extremism here. And then we'll fast forward to more of the modern era and talk and use a case study to talk about certainly an event here that captured not only the attention of everyone in Michigan, but the nation and arguably the world. And that was the plot to kidnap Governor Whitmer in October of 2020, which still is not concluded from a legal perspective. And then we'll wrap up, and I really want to do get your questions and perspectives, because I don't want it to just be me talking the whole time. I also think it's really interesting for me to be here on stage with the Hauenstein Center. Colonel Hauenstein, his background is a military intelligence officer that I learned in preparation, so always honored to be in the presence of an institution that has some connection to the professional world that I was in the intelligence and also the Ford Foundation. So I teach at the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. So it's really nice to have these shared connections on stage. So with that, here's a little bit of a description about what we'll try to get into. And then again, I do want to take the last 20 minutes or so to get your questions and perspectives and comments. So let's start kind of in the Wayback Machine, going back to the 1960s era, let's say, in the United States is sort of a jumping off point. There has been a longer history of domestic extremism or political violence in the US, but I think it's interesting if we start there in the 60s and then kind of fast forward to where we are now. And if you can see the slide from where you're sitting, and it may be a little hard to read, what I tried to do is come up with this color schema to represent these different sort of ideological trends or movements that were happening in the extremism world, first that were, or sometimes occurring overseas, but then having manifestations here. But then also some of these ideas and movements and even groups that are very unique to the United States that we haven't seen necessarily replicated in other parts of the world. And that, I think, just speaks to the diverse nature of what this threat has looked like over time. And hopefully the graph will be able to animate correctly and then also kind of paint some of these trends. So I know we're not in the Q&A section yet, but just I wanted to get your thinking caps on from a participation standpoint. So just kind of a poll question to the audience. All you got to do is raise your hand. How many of you kind of remember what it was like in the late 1960s and the early 1970s and how divided the country was politically? Now, I will tell you, I was born in 1968, so I have no real recollection of what that was like. But if you were a little older, you would know. And I would argue that the country at a political level was very divided back then, arguably even more so than it is now. But that those political divisions spawned a domestic extremism phenomena then that we don't see replicated now. And I think that's really fascinating that 50 plus years ago, there was a much more diverse political extremism landscape here in the US versus what it looks like today. And so that's hopefully what this this graph will try to show. So again, these different colors try to align to these different groups or ideologies or movements, and maybe that'll be clear as this slide starts to animate. But if we look at this 20-year stretch from the 60s to the 80s, and this isn't the totality of what the threat environment looked like, but just kind of broad strokes, there are a lot of different colors here. And I think that is a really interesting picture when you just take a step back and look at the different types of political extremists, either beliefs or groups or ideas that were out there. And they spanned the ideological spectrum from the far right to the far left. Again, if that's the right construct to use. And so maybe kind of starting at the top of the chart here and kind of working our way down, I mean, there was a lot of red in that time, and the red is meant to reflect what I would consider, you know, these far left movements that were active here in the United States. And some of these movements also either drew inspiration from sort of the Soviet Marxist-Leninist ideology that was certainly dominant at the time, either from a liberation movement perspective or just that perspective of, you know, the Soviet influence in the West and the Soviet Union trying to do everything they could to make things difficult here. So going back to that time frame, we had, you know, far left groups like the Weather Underground, if people remember that group, and that was based out of the broader student protest movement that was generating or coming together as a result of the Vietnam War. But yeah, Weather Underground, driven by these student sort of extremists, and the tactics they used here domestically were sort of these classic terrorism tactics that you would see overseas. You know, bombings, attempted murders, arsons. I mean, they were serious. This wasn't just sort of playtime for the Weather Underground. And that, it wasn't one single unified group, but the Weather Underground sort of operation was active for several years, and several people got arrested as a result of the political violence that they were engaged in. So you had sort of a larger sort of group or a movement with the Weather Underground, and then you had a really small one, like this one called anyone remember the Symbionese Liberation Army? And I'll throw the question, who was sort of the person who represented whatever that threat looked like from this very idiosyncratic group here? Who was that person here in the United States? Patty Hearst, right? Exactly. She
you know, got kidnapped by this group on the West Coast, and they sort of brainwashed her, and then she got involved in all the sort of the illegal activities they were involved in, including, you know, that famous picture of her trying to rob the bank, and she walks in with the machine gun. And so you have this really small group, but is also drawing inspiration from, you know, these Marxist, Leninist, revolutionary ideals that were out there, and also engaging in political violence. One of the fascinating things about the Semenese Liberation Army is that probably still to this day, the biggest urban gun battle that has been conducted here in the United States by an extremist group and law enforcement was with a shootout at a safe house in LA with four or five of these Semenese Liberation Army activists and LAPD. And based on, you know, the historical record, about 4,000 rounds were exchanged in this gunfight that lasted several hours, which I don't think we've seen anything like that in the United States since. And I believe the people who were sort of holed up in this safe house and shooting, trying to shoot it out with LAPD, they died in a fire of the house. And I think that also showed their commitment to the cause, however strange it was. And then we had, you know, other groups like, you know, this one, the 19 May Communist Organization, which, you know, name tells you is drawing its inspiration from the Marxist-Leninist ideals that were being promoted overseas. So that was sort of the far left end of the spectrum. But we also had a very active far right threat in this time that was also sort of ideologically diverse. And there was no single group that was sort of pulling the strings in this far right world. So we had the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. We had this really strange group, almost like a cult in Arkansas, called the Covenant Sword and the Arm of the Lord. There was another organization that sort of drew on similar sort of white supremacist beliefs, but also neo-Nazi ones called the Aryan Nations. And again, these were groups that were active in the U.S. in the 70s and 80s that were just as threatening as the far left ones, and using similar tactics and intent on killing people. Again, they weren't just sitting around the campfire chit-chatting about things. They were actually trying to sort of operationalize their ideas and their plans. So we had a far right threat that was intense. And then we had other sort of types of movements and ideas. So the Black Liberation Army, which led into the new Black Panther movement about a decade plus later. We had the beginnings of sort of single issue groups like the Animal Liberation Front in the 70s, which then spawned another group called the Earth Liberation Front a few years later. We had a Puerto Rican separatist group called the Macheteros that was also violent, took up a lot of time and resources for the FBI in this period. So again, in this 20-year stretch here, there's a lot going on in the U.S. And what I think is interesting now, people have completely forgotten is this is what the threat environment used to look like here from domestic terrorism. Again, very intense, spread across this ideological spectrum, but also not geographically located to one particular part of the country, and, you know, pretty serious tactics and lethal attacks as well. But it's almost like this wasn't part of history because we don't talk about it, but this was the reality of what domestic extremism looked like then. And then if we move forward a little bit, the colors start to change and the activity starts to change. So I would argue from the late 80s to the early 2000s, some of that activity started to die down, partly because of arrests and disruptions and FBI focus working with state and local law enforcement. But there were also other things happening both around the world and the country. You know, the Vietnam sort of era had ended. That high level of activism and protests had receded to a degree. But we still had threats and we still had groups. The one that I am still really fascinated by, you know, here we are 40 years later, is a group called The Order, which also drew from some of these same beliefs and ideas and white supremacy. I wouldn't call them a neo-Nazi group, but certainly white supremacists. Anyone here ever heard of The Order before? They, outside of all the groups here up until this time, probably the most dangerous in the United States. Responsible for 5 murders, to include a talk show host named Alan Berg in Denver, if anyone remembers that attack. And he was killed because of his Jewish identity, and he was very outspoken against, you know, people who were in this world of white supremacy. And they deliberately targeted him and killed him as he was pulling into his house in Denver, just basically shot him dead outside his car. And not only, you know, were they willing to engage in these kind of, you know, targeted killings, but they were also successful in these bank robberies and heists. And at one point, they had managed to accumulate about $4 million in 1980s money. And the goal for the leader of this group was to use that money to basically spread the goals and the values of the order to a much broader pool of like-minded individuals in the United States. And the order was, for the most part, kind of centered in the Pacific Northwest. But the leader of this group, his goal was to make this, like, really spark a revolution inside the United States and sort of have this much more dangerous white supremacist movement kind of rise up. Thankfully, that didn't happen, but that was the goal. And again, they had intent, they had some capability, and they wanted to do more. And much like the Seminese Liberation Army a decade prior, the order, the core group of the order, after a number of people got arrested in the aftermath of the Alan Berg murder, were holed up in another safe house. And anyone know where Whidbey Island is? And off the coast of Seattle and the state of Washington, holed up in the safe house here, there, FBI agents kind of cornered them, and another massive shootout with the FBI. And just like in the Seminese Liberation Army shootout a decade prior, everyone died when this house caught fire, and no one wanted to escape. They would rather, you know, die and you know, stand and fight and die as the house is burning. So, you know, just another indication into the mindset. So that order threat was high, even though it didn't last that long. But then we start to see by the early 90s, you don't necessarily see the white supremacist neo-Nazi threat sort of coming back. And we certainly didn't see a significant element of the far left, or, you know, the violent far left threat coming. But in the aftermath of, if folks remember, the standoff at Ruby Ridge in 1992 with an individual named Randy Weaver and his wife. And it was a tragic event on multiple levels. But this standoff between FBI and this sort of survivalist named Randy Weaver and his family just spiraled out of control and led to the unfortunate death of Randy Weaver's wife and the death of his 14-year-old son. And then just almost 6 to 8 months later, we had the incident at in Waco, Texas, with the cult with David Koresh. And again, that's probably not the outcome the FBI wanted, was that compound to go up in flames and to have more than 50 people die. Once again, you know, people inside a house refusing to come out would rather die inside the house, just like some of these other events, once the building caught on fire. But in a short amount of time, the combination of Ruby Ridge in 1992 and Waco in April 93, when the compound burned down, sparked an anti-government movement throughout the US and really led to the rise of what we would now consider sort of these unsanctioned militia groups in the United States. And to bring it back home, I mean, we had one here in Michigan, the Michigan Militia, and depending on, you know, sort of scholars about the militia movement, and that's definitely not me, they would argue that when this anti-government and militia movement started to rise up in the early 90s, early to mid-90s, the Michigan Militia was really influential at a nationwide level. Now, again, they weren't organizing to overtly overthrow the government or engage in acts of terrorism, but there were some foundational issues that were there. And, you know, it wasn't just only the Michigan militia that was active in this time. There are lots of other militia groups across the country. And no one really knows how many militia groups there are now inside the United States. This whole question of legality, is it legal to be in a self-proclaimed militia group in your state? That's that's an interesting question. There are lots of different perspectives on that. But there are a couple organizations that actually try to track the known militia groups. One is the Anti-Defamation League, and the other is the Southern Poverty Law Center. And if their pictures are right, they put out annual assessments on this. Their data shows that there are hundreds of militia groups around the country, known militia groups. And again, is that an accurate depiction of reality? Maybe it is, maybe it's not. Is everybody in a militia group expressly intent on conducting terrorist attacks or overthrowing the government? No, but again, like there's a reason why people join these groups, and it doesn't take much to move from organizing as a militia to then potentially moving in a completely different direction, and we have an example of that here. And then if we look at where we are now, where we've come over the last, 15, 20 years, again, we start to see some different sort of groupings, different timelines, some colors from the past showing up. But we have groups, if you paid attention to news about the arrests coming out of the January 6th investigation, of which there have now been over 1,000 people arrested by the FBI as a result of January 6th. Every one of these circles that I put a red dash around, these are people in these groups have been arrested as a result of January 6th. Now, it doesn't mean that they came together to storm the Capitol or get involved in this insurrection, but I think it's pretty interesting when you start seeing the connections of some of these groups to at least January 6th. And again, what does that mean for the future of domestic extremism here? But we have sort of these anti-government groups like the Three Percenters, the Oath Keepers is probably the most infamous of all of them. From a legal perspective on January 6th, the most serious charges that have been brought forward by the federal government are on seditious conspiracy. And the entire leadership of the Oath Keepers has been hit with these seditious conspiracy charges, which are serious felony charges. I mean, if their cases go to trial and they get charged, I mean, these are 20-year sentences for each charge. So these anti-militia groups were active in January 6th, but then we had, people associated with a group, if that's the right word, the Proud Boys. I don't know if folks are familiar with, the Proud Boys. I'm not even sure what to call the Proud Boys. Are they anti-government? Are they white supremacists? Are they neo-fascists? That's kind of a term that I came up with because I can't put them in any one of these other ideological boxes. But that's another group in which several of their leaders have been hit with these seditious conspiracy charges as a result of their involvement on January 6th. And then, other folks charged as a result of January 6th. The one that I have probably the most struggle kind of trying to put into this framework that I've come up with is QAnon. If you're familiar with this sort of conspiracy theory known as QAnon, I myself can't even really describe the principles that are baked into the conspiracy theory, but all that said, again, a number of people who are self-avowed QAnon supporters arrested and charged as a result of crimes because of January 6th. And so that's another interesting picture of where we are now. But just like there were white supremacist and neo-Nazi groups in the 60s, 70s, into the 80s, they're still around too. Still small, still, kind of fragmented, but still very potentially dangerous. And what I find interesting about these sort of white supremacist neo-Nazi groups like the Adam Waffen Division or the Base, they're not organizing to do anything else other than just kill people. I mean, that is their principal goal. So these small neo-Nazi groups look like your traditional classic terrorist groups of their intent and their orientation of just on violent action, and they're not really involved in trying to do anything else. And if anyone's ever heard of the Base, that's another group that in my mind almost took inspiration from this group, the Order. The Base also took their name from Al-Qaeda, which translates into the base in English. So I find it interesting that a neo-Nazi group here in the U.S. takes their name from probably the most infamous terrorist group in the world, Al-Qaeda. And when the Governor Whitmer plot was being, or was unfolding, at least in terms of the news, at the same time, the FBI made a couple arrests of the base activists here in Michigan. And at the time, there's a young man named, I think it was Justin Watkins, who apparently was the leader of this fringy neo-Nazi group called the base. But again, he's in our backyard here in Michigan, and he probably was trying to figure out how to move this group into the next phase of violent action. So even something as sinister as the base had a bit of a presence here. So this is the threat picture. And again, I think it's interesting when you can take a step back and look at these different sort of trends and the evolution and going from sort of the 60s to where we are now. And what this doesn't represent are individuals who don't necessarily align themselves to any particular group or ideology, and sometimes can combine several of these at once, but are still motivated to act out violently on behalf of a number of different factors. And that is a very difficult threat too. It's almost, the FBI and law enforcement has more tools and authorities to go after organized groups, but trying to spot the lone wolf or the lone offender, what I would use that term, that is much more difficult. And until that person has done something illegal, there's very little law enforcement or the FBI can do to stop them. And that's why, unfortunately, if you look at the modern track record of successful what I would call domestic terrorist attacks in the US over the past decade, almost all the lethal ones are carried out by lone wolves and lone offenders who just fly under the radar, or their behaviors aren't observed at the right way, or no one reports them, and then they're able to go off and murder innocent people, which is not a good news story. So that's the threat picture. And again, hopefully this has given you something to think about for the Q&A. But let's look at it here in our backyard too. So if we remember the Wolverine Watchmen plot, the news broke about that in October of 2020. But the timeline for how the plot came together was probably about a year prior to the arrest. And so again, mapping out sort of the evolution of the plot, the different tactics that FBI and law enforcement use, it's a pretty interesting case study. Again, this is here in our backyard, not too far away in the Lansing area. So based on a lot of the media reporting that's come out, is that the group came together probably in late 2019, if not early 2020, but they came together before COVID. And so I think that is an interesting insight there. And from everything that's been reported is that it appears they came together because, a relatively small number of individuals, maybe a dozen, if not more, hard to tell kind of what the ideological glue was between them. Partly, these shared anti-government beliefs, partly, interest in sort of paramilitary activity and staunch supporters of the Second Amendment, which isn't illegal, obviously. But the group came together, in this time frame. Based on what's come out in the court documents and media reporting, the thing that transitioned them from perhaps like a bunch of weekend warriors getting together to shoot and, perhaps trade ideas about what they didn't like about the government, the thing that sparked their anger and took the group's focus to something completely different from their original base come together was COVID. And so once the COVID restrictions happened here, and as we remember in Michigan, they were amongst the most intense probably nationwide, and that sparked a lot of popular discontent. Beyond the discontent, we didn't for the most part see plots coming together against politicians or elected officials, but for this group, for whatever reason, COVID was the thing that completely changed their set of beliefs and then their goals about what they wanted to do. And probably between late when the COVID restrictions started into early March and April, a lot of what they were doing was flying under the radar, wasn't detected. And the lucky break, I think, in this case was that one of those people in the original Watchman group, who probably joined for a bunch of different reasons before, became so unnerved about what they were hearing either in person or in these social media chats, that they then went to their local law enforcement agency, and it's still not clear where that was here in Michigan. And then that local law enforcement agency notified FBI Detroit. And that's how the thread got pulled on this plot. Had it not been for that one person who, again, was so unnerved about what they were hearing, and even if it seemed aspirational in this spring timeframe, that was a thing that got the FBI and law enforcement centered on what this group was potentially thinking about and doing. And what I think is so interesting about the plot is that it was being watched both internally. I mean, the FBI was starting to bring in some pretty sort of sophisticated capabilities to understand kind of what was happening within the group, both on the social media side and the kind of the person-to-person side. But the group itself, unbeknownst to them, even though they were being watched, ironically, and their name was the Watchmen, that they went from talking about kidnapping Governor Whitmer and thinking about Governor Whitmer to taking what I was calling concrete sort of operational steps to put this in motion. So they stopped being angry about it, and then they made this decision as a group: we're actually going to try and pull this off. And that was pretty shocking to see as well, once you know the news came out. So the kickoff meeting where they went from brainstorming to, okay, now we're going to put this plot in motion and here are all these different things we're going to do, was in June of 2020 at this meeting in a safe house in Dublin, Ohio. But then from there, they started to engage in tactical training at a farm, I think one of the watchmen had here in Michigan. And so they were conducting, you know, how to shoot and maneuver against, Governor Whitmer and her security detail, which included, you know, targets sort of shoot houses. So, I mean, that's a pretty serious level of commitment to engage. And that they also, even though they didn't know they were being watched, when they did it, they conducted not one, but two dry runs of surveillance on Governor Whitmer's second residence. I think, I don't know if it's in Traverse City, but it's certainly in that area, her summer residence. And they literally got in cars and drove a couple hundred miles and did reconnaissance on the house to, again, try to come up with an operational plan. If we were going to try to kidnap her and literally pull her out of the house, how would we do it? And that's also pretty brazen. Again, you've gone well beyond the aspirational stage if you're willing to do dry runs or surveillance runs against a sitting governor's second residence. Now, the good thing was the FBI and law enforcement was watching it the whole time, but again, they let that sort of play out to understand what the group was thinking about. And I'm sure had the group gone, like had there been some red line for the FBI or, you know, the Michigan State Police and all the other law enforcement agencies that were involved, I'm sure agents would have swooped in and arrested, you know, everyone in their cars, but that didn't happen. But again, that was another kind of pretty brazen aspect to the plot. And then as the into the fall, the thing kept moving forward. They bought stun guns, because that was another part of their concept, was to kidnap Governor Whitmer from her summer residence, literally like shock her with this stun gun, and then put her on a boat and have some, I mean, this sounds crazy when I say it, but this is what these guys were thinking about. And then put her on a boat in the middle of Lake Michigan or somewhere and like tape some kind of mock trial and then execute her right there. And that's what these guys were doing. And that's why all these little pieces were flowing into that. And probably, you know, by after, you know, the stun gun purchase and other things, there must have been some decision either at FBI headquarters, and that was the environment that I worked in my career, with the field office here and in collaboration with, you know, the law enforcement partners here in Michigan, where somebody must have made the decision, you know, we have enough evidence to go forward and try to, you know, bring charges against all the people involved in this case, and now it's just time to make the arrest. And so, if you remember, I think it was the first week of October, October 7th or 8th, and there were multiple arrests made by a dozen or with a dozen or so of these individuals, and in multiple locations, arrests here in Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin. So that must have been a pretty complex thing to pull off from the law enforcement side and make sure no one got hurt in the process. Which, you know, that's always a consideration too. But so the plot got exposed when the arrests happened. But again, there was a much longer trail to it. And the FBI used a lot of pretty sophisticated techniques to keep watch on what was happening throughout this time frame. And then just kind of looking at the faces of the this isn't everybody who was charged. This is only 10 of the 12 or 10 of the 13 or 14. But here's what, you know, the majority of the folks look like. You know, just kind of regular average guys. I think the youngest was in his early 20s and the oldest was in his mid to late 40s. You know, different sort of backgrounds. Some had military experience, some didn't. So there was no sort of single common background or denominator that you know, you could find across all of them. But then as over the past year or so, as the legal proceedings have unfolded against everyone charged, there's been some interesting results. So six of the 14 people charged were charged with federal crimes, and that's what the left side of the slide tries to show. And then the other batch had been charged with Michigan crimes, and this is really interesting. Of the people who were charged with federal crimes, the word terrorism doesn't show up in their charging documents at all, because there's no crime of domestic terrorism. There's other federal crimes you could be charged with, and that's where some of these people got hit with those: conspiracy, kidnapping of a, you know, government official. A couple of people were facing weapons charges too, but the word terrorism doesn't show up, even though I would argue everything I just described looks like an act of terrorism to me, politically and ideologically motivated violence. And on the Michigan charges, even though all these trials are still, they still haven't started, and who knows, some people may roll the dice and try to go to trial. Somebody may take a plea deal, although that hasn't happened yet on the state charge. The word terrorism does show up because Michigan has its own anti-terrorism statute. And Dana Nessel, who's the attorney general, decided to employ some of those terrorism-specific charges against the people hit on the Michigan side, of, you know, the legal side for charges. So we'll see how that plays out, whether the terrorism language and the Michigan trials make a difference in terms of, you know, the results or the sentences, but we don't know how that's going to play out because, again, no one's trial has started here. And on the federal side, two of the six pled guilty. They were the first two, actually, of the six to have their legal fate determined. And, you know, there must have been a conversation with the U.S. Attorney's Office for a lesser charge or sentence. You're still be found guilty, but the sentence won't be as long. So two of the six pled, and then the other four, two were found not guilty on all charges. Then the other two, there was sort of a hung trial where the jury couldn't make a decision on the first trial, and that was an interesting kind of moment where you've got two pled guilty, two found not guilty, and then there was some thought, would the Department of Justice try to retry the two people who had had that sort of hung jury, or would they just kind of walk away? And interestingly, the two that were initially found, or that had the hung jury results, Barry Croft and Adam Fox, who are two of the principals in this plot, that's Barry Croft right there. On the retrial, we're found guilty. So, you know, different legal outcome here as well. And then looking at sort of where we're going to go in the future on this, again, there's no answer. There's no right answer here. But if I've just described kind of what the, you know, the past and the current looks like in terms of domestic extremism, here I think are a number of different factors that are going to shape this threat into the future. And it's really hard, even for someone like me who thinks about this and studies it all day long, like which one of these factors will be the most prominent, which is the one that we're sort of weakest on from a sort of a policy perspective, you know, where do we need to kind of build out more capabilities and authorities? And I still struggle with coming up with the answers here, but I think in total, all these factors at some level are going to shape what the future of this threat looks like here in the United States. So will we see more on the far right end of the spectrum, which I would argue that's what we've seen over the past, you know, 10 to 15 years? Will we see a resurgence of the far left kind of extremism that we saw in the 60s and 70s? Maybe we will, maybe we won't, based on how some of these factors play out. Or will there be other types of beliefs and ideas that emerge that we haven't even detected yet that will also make a difference when it comes to extremism here? So maybe that's a good good point to end on. And now I'll open it up to questions and comments. All right, guys, don't make me call on you because I'm not tracking participation like I do in my classes, but hopefully I've given you enough to come up with some perspectives.
You didn't speak to the relative sizes of these groups initially. You mentioned a few that were very small,
right.
But and you had Antifa up there, and how does because they're such a sort of a not really organized,
exactly.
It's just sort of
a movement.
Yeah,
it's, right.
Could you speak to, you know, the sort of the sizes of some of these groups? How large they are? How many adherents they had?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And again, I think this notion of, you know, kind of trying to bound things by just scope or size can give you some answers or perhaps not. So just like there's this broad sort of diversity ideologically, again, you know, different ends of the spectrum, I think it's the same, at least when you look at the formal groups. Some are big, some are small, some aren't even groups. Like Antifa, I would argue, is not a group. It is an ideological movement. QAnon is certainly not a group. It is a movement, but there may be hundreds of thousands of people, or not more, in the U.S. who actually believe in these conspiracy theories, and a much smaller number who are willing to act out violently on them. But I wouldn't call QAnon a group, much the way I wouldn't call Antifa a group. But how many people believe in, again, the goals and the beliefs of Antifa? It's probably a significant number. It may not be as many as QAnon, but it's probably you know, in the hundreds, if not thousands, around the country. I'm not an expert on Antifa, but my understanding is they organize kind of at a local level in chapters. But just because you organize as a chapter doesn't mean you're willing to engage in violence. So I think that becomes more individualized in some of these circumstances.
No, you're talking. Hi. Can you flip back to the screen that had your, I don't know, 15 or however many items that were going to impact?
Oh, yep.
There you go. Because I was scanning that and looking, and I didn't see economics or financial duress. Did I miss that?
Yeah, you know what? I probably left it off intentionally. And again, as someone who has tried to get into the minds of extremists, both on the international side, on the domestic side, one thing that seems to be pretty common, no matter, again, whether you're looking at the overseas end of the threat or the domestic one here, economics generally don't drive people to political violence, at least at a broad strokes level. Like, there are always outliers to that general caveat, but, you know, in almost every example you can think of, the socioeconomic status of an individual is not predictive at all whether they're going to go down that path of political extremism or violent action. And if anything, what I find quite interesting is, depending on, again, what group or threat you look at, that they almost tend to be represented by sort of an upper class kind of mentality. That was certainly the case, or highly educated kind of socioeconomic status. That was the case in the far left here in the United States in the 60s and 70s, because again, that came out of the student protest movement across campuses. Now again, this is not domestic terrorism, but look at a group like Al-Qaeda and the people who formed Al-Qaeda going back to Afghanistan in the 80s. I mean, these are all the elite of Arab sort of society coming together in a distant place like Afghanistan to fight the Soviet Union. Economics had nothing to do with their motivation to come together then. And then once they changed to more of an anti-US orientation. But Osama bin Laden was the son of a construction billionaire from Saudi Arabia, and his deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, was an Egyptian doctor, right? So these are people who are highly educated, have walked away from these lives where they could have been incredibly successful in doing something else and something more positive for society, but they chose a completely different path. And I could, could give you another terrorist group and come up with the same set of circumstances. So, and from what I've seen, socioeconomic status tends not to be a driver most of the time.
Okay, we have a point of disagreement. So
yeah,
I'll leave it at that.
Yep, absolutely.
Professor Ali, thank you very much for such an interesting presentation. I have a question. There's always been the debate about American exceptionalism, and it's a notion that's often debunked. However, with your very rich and interesting topic, I wonder if there is a sense in which America in some sense is exceptional in the modern world with regard to the terrorism that we experience in this country all across the political spectrum. Your comments, please.
So just help me unpack the question a little bit. By exceptionalism, what are you trying to get at there? That our phenomena isn't as sort of dangerous, as acute as it is in other places, or is there something just unique to the threat here versus other countries?
Yes, it's strictly a question. I'm not coming at it with a preconceived answer. I'm going back to the Tocquevillian sense that America is, in some sense, exceptional, and compared to countries in the Eastern Hemisphere,
right,
for example. So I'm asking you, is the range of the ideological spectrum of terrorism in our country, the intensity of it, are we a bellwether of terrorist movements around the world? In what sense might we be exceptional?
Yeah, that's a great question, now that I understand it better. I think it depends sometimes, depending on where we are in history and what's happening in the world around us. I would argue that certainly contrasting the domestic terrorism phenomena here versus how it's manifesting in Europe, it seems worse in Europe than it is here. Far broader in scale and far more sort of entrenched, and our European partners are really struggling with how to combat it because they're smaller than we are and they don't have as many resources as we do to tackle it. But there, I could go up and down the line of European countries that seem to have just even on the far right end of the spectrum, have it worse than we do. Germany seems to be almost a first amongst equals in that perspective, to the point where, and this is a crazy example when you think about it, Germany, again, much smaller military than ours, but still, strong partner, and they have a very focused special operations capability called there's a company size, or maybe a little bit bigger, brigade size special operations element called the KSK, which we have partnered with around the world in various missions. Anyways, through a German domestic security investigation, and this has all been reported in the news, they had to disband an entire company of these highly trained KSK operators because all of them were neo-Nazi sympathizers and extremists. So you think about it, they had to basically eliminate a capability within their own military because it had been so seated with this really pernicious ideology. How that happened, I mean, that didn't happen overnight, probably happened over time. So that to me is like a clear example of how this can look in another country. We don't have, I mean, we have probably individuals within the military over time who also, you know, fed into some of these beliefs. We haven't had to disband platoons and companies and, you know, higher level military units because of that kind of threat. So yeah, I think we're doing better than some of our European partners, but it doesn't mean that the threat is zero here, like I described. That's a great question, thank you.
Professor Ali, I missed the beginning of your talk. I was held up, but I thought that the part I heard was excellent. And so Americans today get so much information from media, and many people like to watch one cable news network or another, obviously. And do you think it's possible, given the media climate and threats from the right and the left that you mentioned here, that people get the whole picture? I mean, if you know, certain networks might downplay or ignore threats from the other side, and maybe so in this fractured media environment, do you think it's possible to get like big overview of the whole thing?
Yeah, it's another really good question. Yeah, I do think there is probably some, you know, I think I've got on here, I have social media, but not sort of mainstream media. But yes, there is probably some amplification of these ideas or beliefs or the threat in the media landscape. And again, how does that play out when it comes to the people thinking about then violent action? You know, in some ways, like the more attention you put on something, the more perhaps you know, you'll manifest a threat out of that. And I myself, like, I am in the media all the time providing commentary on these types of issues, and I have to think carefully sometimes about, is it the right moment for me to say something, and am I just fanning the flames of that are going to lead to, you know, these grievances down the line, or, you know, can I just give a completely, you know, neutral and objective perspective and help kind of tamp things down. That's what I try to do when I engage in kind of the media commentary. Whether that happens or not, you know, I don't know. But yes, I do think, you know, sort of the media role in this is significant. But is it the most significant amongst all these other factors? It's empirically really hard to know that. And in addition to the kind of the role of the media, then, you know, how do you gauge political rhetoric as well? Like how much value is there in heightened or, you know, loud political rhetoric in animating people to political violence? You know, maybe some of that played out on January 6th, because I have to believe that not everybody who stormed the Capitol was intent on doing that until, you know, they got to D.C. that day. You know, there were clearly people who were thinking about engaging and doing something before, and that's where these seditious conspiracy charges come in. But the overwhelming, you know, majority of people who've even been charged and arrested on January 6th have been, it happened more organically, right? And so again, I think there could be something from a rhetorical perspective. There was another really interesting case study last summer, if people remember, in the aftermath of all the media attention on the document search on President Trump's house or residence in Mar-a-Lago and, you know, this classified material that they found there, that there was an individual who apparently was so angered by, you know, what the FBI was doing or all the attention that was being put on President Trump that tried to attack the Cincinnati FBI field office. Like, in the universe of bad ideas, that's up there, right? I mean, that's a suicide mission. And I don't say this in jest. He got killed in a shootout with law enforcement, but that shows you how people can just get blinded by anger in the moment. And that person was probably already on some pathway to being radicalized. And for whatever reason, you know, the Trump Mar-a-Lago search tipped him over the edge, but he was brazen enough, if that's the right word, to try to attack an FBI field office. And he lost his life as a result of that. And again, that's the climate we're in, where it's either the media attention or, you know, all these other factors, and then, you know, something happens and then people just snap and then, you know, they'll try to do something. But trying to find that lone wolf or that sole, you know, lone offender in the run-up, it's really hard.
We have time for one final question.
Thank you for this talk, Professor. One of the things that it's helpful for me to have takeaways. So my takeaways, and I want you to correct me if I'm off target here, is that things are not as dangerous as they were in the 60s or 70s, and I do remember those days. We seem to be more splintered with these kinds of activities and groups than the 60s and 70s. There's just more of them across a wider continuum and more diverse. And that we don't seem to be, based on questions asked and answered, not as bad as other nations. You didn't spend a lot of time on that, but you know, this is pretty depressing. So I just want to make sure that we,
right,
you know, we remember that part. And yet, one of the things that I found really interesting was that gap between the 90s and the 2010s, and that's when internet hit. And I was thinking about the order and how successful they might have been,
right,
had they had the internet, because that in turn makes more noise, confusion, and agitation, where people can't even think about things and really get to the point of thoughtful discernment and understanding and a sense of calm, if you will.
That's a really good observation about this. Like, there aren't a lot of colors in this,
right,
almost 10, 15 year time frame. I have a potential answer that whether I'm right or wrong, you know, that's up for debate. But I think the reason why we didn't see a lot of domestic terrorism or extremism here in this period of time because of 9/11 and the U.S. national security focus, I mean, swung so hard on the Al-Qaeda threat overseas. And I think for people who are, you know, on various ends of this ideological spectrum here in the United States, they must have seen that response. This is what we were willing to do against extremist groups overseas. You'd be nuts to stick your head up now and try to pull off a plot or, you know, give law enforcement a reason to go after you. Didn't mean that there weren't, you know, threats, but just so much lower on the domestic side than the international side. And again, you know, there have been a lot of people say that was a mistake. Like, we took our eye off the ball of domestic extremism in that 10 or 15 year time frame after 9/11, because in a way it looks like this now because we weren't paying attention to it back then. I mean, that's a fair criticism. But as someone who was in that world from 2002 to 2018, all I can tell you is that, you know, the Al-Qaeda threat and then the ISIS threat overseas looked so dangerous to the country that, and they were trying to pull off attacks and plots that were so different in scale and scope than, you know, the single lone wolf trying to conduct an attack here. Doesn't mean that it was the right thing to do. But again, you have to prioritize on the threat that's in front of you and the thing that you think can do the most harm. And certainly when I was in government over that stretch, yeah, we were hyper-focused on international terrorism. But at the same time, now we have this resurgence and we got to figure out a way to kind of get to the right balance between the two. But that was a great question and observation, so thank you. All right, caller, are we out of time?
We are. Let's give John a round of applause.
Well, thank you guys so much.
Thanks for listening to an episode of The Rewind, a podcast series by the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies. The audio for this episode was captured by Mark Washburn of Gyrospedia. This episode was produced and sound engineered by Maddie Miller. The Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University is inspired by Ralph Hauenstein's life of leadership and service and is dedicated to raising a community of ethical, effective leaders for the 21st century. For more information on our center, our Peter C. Cook Leadership Academy, or our Common Ground Initiative, visit our website at www.gvsu.edu/hc. To keep up with our current events and recurring initiatives, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn, all of which can be found linked below. If you liked this episode, consider giving us a review and rating so we can be found by other podcast listeners. Again, thank you for listening.